From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we continue to examine the question of whether or not the presidency of Donald Trump has been derailed by his opponents, and if he is now... For more on that, we bring you the remainder of our conversation earlier this week with Professor Tony Montero, the organizer and political scientist from Philadelphia, who is a regular contributor here at CPR.
People overlook and underestimate how widespread poverty and suffering and joblessness is in this country.
That's right.
It's not just the miners in West Virginia. It's the manufacturing workers in the Midwest. I mean, Cleveland of today is not Cleveland of 30 years ago.
Hey, walk around any city that this broadcast is being heard on. Go walk a couple of blocks and find out how many people are either in foreclosure or eviction.
Yes.
Alone,
yes.
Anywhere in the country.
Yes. And of course, the crisis of white privilege, which is forcing masses of working class white people, if not to fundamentally change their worldview, at least to begin to question some things.
Right.
And that's what we saw with the Trump thing. They responded to no intervention wars, peace with Russia, and jobs at home, and an end to the neoliberal policy, globalist policies. Well, I mean, it wasn't well formed. I mean, but they were responding to their basic class interests. That is a beginning. Now, I am not one to say that we're witnessing the end of a beginning. I think we are still in the beginning stages, and the contradictions that led to Trump's election and really to Clinton's defeat are still with us. And we have to have forces on the ground with imagination, with strategic vision, with some experience in what we used to call coalition or united front politics. And let me just say, in united front and coalition politics, the basic thing is that you don't agree with all of your coalition partners on everything.
Right.
But you unite on those things that you can agree on. If people from the so-called alt-right are picketing the White House against an opposition to Trump's bombing of Syria, I think there's a point of unity with that demonstration. And not to attack them and violently attack them and so on. We have to go back to politics. The so-called black bloc, which, you know, because they are masked and so on, you don't know who these people are. And some of these newly minted leftists are just incapable, and they cannot lead the people. In fact, we don't have, that's not even a threat that they will lead the people, but they become agent provocateurs and disruptors more than anything else.
Or just serve the function of being baffles, that the space that they're occupying is a place where the activity stops and it might otherwise be occupied by the conduit.
Yeah, right. That's all.
Yep.
And so, you know, going forward, I think, you know, the work that you're doing in social media, in this podcast, that others are doing in different places, this has to continue. You know, Huey P. Newton in 1967 was interviewed while he was in prison, and he talked about the July 26th movement, which was Fidel Castro and Che Guevara's movement, which was the vanguard of toppling Batista. And Huey Newton said at that time that the July 26th movement was an education movement, that the political education of the masses is the critical role for any progressive and any revolutionary. The people pretty much know how to organize themselves and can organize themselves. The question is connecting the dots. The question is giving a political vision, a strategic vision of what the fight is and how we can unite to win in the fight. And that's what we have to return to. Protest is good, but protest does not make a revolutionary and does not make a revolutionary movement.
Yeah. Look, you had what you just described in Cuba, the process that began there. Russia, you had the 1905 revolution before the 1917 revolution. And the establishment, for example, of the Petrograd Soviet, of the Working Workers' Council in Petrograd, that ended up becoming the model for the organization of the USSR, actually. Some dozen years prior to the October Revolution. China, the same. These are dress rehearsals that take place, more or less. And this phenomenon has been described by, you have Marx looking at the Paris Commune as a rehearsal and the number of events before that as rehearsals for that, et cetera, et cetera. Everyone that has seriously written about human history sees that these, you know, development processes are processing, and that right. You know, we, our activity is always in a state of becoming. So those lessons here, you know, we have a lot. I mean, what you were describing about what's happened in D.C. recently to that alt-right guy, you have a bunch of people who self-identify as alt-right, or some, who knows, out of that crowd, some as Nazis and whatever, Satan and stuff, protesting war at the White House, and you have the anti-war, you know, apparatus attacking them, or you have others who claim to be anti-war attacking them on other grounds, okay, but they're attacking them on the day that they're there protesting war. You talk about political
organizing. It's very interesting. It's very interesting. Just on that point, the same forces who were attacking these people who were protesting at the White House against the bombing of Syria, these people, the ones protesting the protesters, had no problem in being a part of a movement called calling itself the Resistance, who were, in fact, we now know, Hillary Clinton people who were also pro-war with Russia people. I mean, they didn't attack them violently.
Right.
You know? I mean, I don't know whether I'm making myself
clear.
Yeah,
I mean, it's the same thing. Look, when we saw this phenomenon among the elites of the parties, for decades, we're told we have to vote for the Democrats because the Republicans are evil incarnate. This is the Democratic leadership, the Democratic politicians. The moment that they have a crisis among themselves in the form of Sanders, Trump, and the more essentially the voters and discontent that those candidacies signified and tapped into, that moment, all of a sudden, they could embrace Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio and everyone else as being sane voices of reason. On a dime, they turn. And it's the same, you know, that's sort of the symbolic of the more, you know, the involved processes that you're describing, you know, among people on the ground.
Yeah, and you know, again, you see, this is a period of sharpening contradictions, and I know that's you know, that's the phrase that everybody uses, but in fact it is a truth. But unlike previous periods, the sharpest manifestations of these contradictions have to do with the international situation and whether or not the U.S. empire and U.S. imperialism will be forced to retreat. You know, and now with the literal defeat of Trump and what I think we could say has been an actual and effective coup d'etat, all of the war plans are back on the table. And I think, of course it's going to be difficult as long as Trump is in the White House, because you don't know when, and they don't know when, he's going to go off message and start tweeting again.
Right.
But do they think that there can be a successful outcome of a confrontation, a war with North Korea? I mean, who wins that one?
No one.
No one. It's a lose-lose situation. Or do they think that they can impose a no-fly zone in Syria with the Russians already there?
Yeah, there's a million other questions, too. I hear today, yesterday, you know, they're doing, like, heavy-duty air raid drills and stuff in Japan. Now, you know, on the one hand, you've had Abe and predecessors moving towards this in almost steady march, really, to deal with Article 9 of their Constitution, which, if read both in the meaning that it was written at the time and also in just the plain language, even, you know, if it were scrunched through a Hollywood translation from the Japanese, it was an anti-war provision in the Constitution, and that's been, you know, slowly abrogated with the active encouragement most recently of the Obama administration. And the people now are being drilled to expect, you know, in case of an air attack, they'd only have 10 minutes of an air attack from North Korea. So they're being prepared emotionally, psychologically for this. Do they do what is expected and cow and support aggressive policies out of fear, or do they turn that fear and their reaction to these conditions on the government officials who are to blame for this condition?
Well, in South Korea, they're doing what you the latter.
Right.
And it seems that, first of all, the impeachment of the previous president and driving her from office had a lot to do with the labor conditions and the labor movement and the general strikes, but also the fact that the South Korean people are weary of war and belligerency and being used as a front line for the U.S. military provocations against North Korea. Their own people, my God. I think things cannot go in the ways that these military planners and generals want it to go. And you know, it's already something of a debacle, because they were telling us a couple of weeks ago that the USS Vinson and all of the warships with it were steaming towards the waters of North Korea. And then we see pictures where it's really still in the waters of Indonesia.
Right, that's right.
I mean, it's...
And, you know, you have to understand, the audience, you know, folks need to understand, the Russians know where the boats are. They've got satellites. Right. The Chinese know where the boats are. They've got satellites. This is for our consumption.
Right, right. Or even as bad, though not as bad, is the 59 Tomahawk missiles, most of which maybe didn't even reach the place that they were supposed to hit. And the airfield that they hit was in operation the next day.
Jesus.
So, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, you know, they are in a state, I would say, a state of confusion and chaos at the top of the U.S. state.
Yeah.
There's still accounts to be settled within the FBI and between the FBI and the CIA and the head of the FBI and the Clinton people. I mean, this guy Comey is still not out of the deep water, you know. And the question is, can he swim back to shore?
Right.
This is a singular moment. I'll put it that way. It is an unusual moment in the history of this country. The country is poorer, perhaps, than it's been in 80 years, with no prospect of things getting better. People are in deeper debt than ever before, and the masses of people feel that there is no hope for a future for them and their children and grandchildren under the current regime. And we, I think, should look forward to uprisings and rebellions all over this nation. I think what we have to request is that the so-called left get out of the way of the people. Stop trying to get in front of something that you cannot lead and that you did not start, and let the people find their way to this new moment, this new vision, this new understanding of what they must do to free themselves from this economic oppression and war.
You know, you mentioned 80 years ago. So we're talking 80 years ago. Today would be April 26th, 1937.
Mm-hmm.
We had Roosevelt and Alphabet City of programs and, you know, big uptake in the role of the state and the economy and mm-hmm. People in the street, powerful movements of the left that were finding some expression in the political process, or at least apparently were, and in terms of policy, there were certain concessions made. All of that, nevertheless, really didn't resolve the economic problems, which were instead resolved by war, by World War II, at least on behalf of American workers, who saw their factories as the last factories standing and the world as a market with American military power to protect it. Here we are 80 years later. The Keynesian economics that were used in the 30s and 40s clearly aren't going to work now. They're not allowed to be used in any event, whether they would work or not. Most of the wealth that was created that belonged to the working class and middle class in the post-middle class, in other words, as they became workers, they had a larger share of wealth. Their homes, their, you know, second homes, real estate holdings, all that stuff metabolized by this economy. The deepest most obscene inequality of wealth and income that we've seen in the history of this country, really, and certainly post 1865. And nevertheless, a repeat of the conditions. In other words, we're at the same point we were before. The only solution to that problem really was war. Now, we don't even have the options that were used before the war as tools, because everyone's already been impoverished. The weapons of war, by the way, much more final than they were 80 years ago. Yeah. And some real competing centers of power on the world stage for the first time since 1945.
Mm-hmm.
Where's it go?
Well, first of all, you know, this is a very interesting thing. You know, you could ratchet up war hysteria, and you could get the Japanese and Germans to initiate wars of aggression and colonial expansion in the 1930s. Today, I think humanity is more united against war than ever. Those who want war are a very, very, very tiny part of the population. The problem is they're in power. Mm. But the people in South Korea don't want war. The people in North Korea don't want war. The Russians don't want war. The Syrians don't want war. The Libyan people have seen what an imperialist aggression against their country has meant, similarly in Iraq. People all over the Middle East are seeing what Israeli aggression has meant to Lebanon and the Palestinians, what Saudi aggression has meant to Yemen, to the Yemeni people. People do not want war. And, you know, as quiet as it's kept, all over the world, people are demonstrating and speaking out for peace, especially where the war makers are most active in Northeast Asia, South Korea, North Korea, certainly the Russian people, the French people. That's what that election was about, pulling out of the EU and NATO and better relationships with Russia. That's pro-peace. I mean, you can label it the far right, but at the grassroots level, it's a pro-peace impulse.
Right.
But with it comes all of the problems that we that we inherit from the past of capitalism and white supremacy. The immigration question, which of course is created by imperialist wars. But all of this is a part of the moment. But I think the key thing is that people do not want war, and people are voting their sentiment against war, and they're raising their voices against war. And that is the key to all of this.
You know, there's some very interesting kernel in the, what you just said, that to me is something really needs to be explored more of late. White supremacy as a concept, as a religion, as a practice, as an institution, was developed in order to, and as a handmaiden of imperialism, to enable imperialism. That we had to establish, organize society along lines we will define, with us at the center of the power, halo around us. All right, so we'll make them all the same color. Okay, that'll work good because we got them in this place here and that place there, and we have them as soldiers of a national state or whatever the circumstances were that made them choose skin color instead of eye color or geography as the basis, because any one of them would do to, if it served the purpose of this small group of people maintaining control of the rest of us. So you have that at the core. In other words, imperialism's needs and wants driving human relations. And as people are criticizing white supremacy and enabling imperialism, like we saw with Obama, really, in Libya, in the broadest and deepest way, because of what happened in Africa in the wake of that. The installation of the destruction of the hope of Africa that was vested in Libya is not all its hope, but there was a lot of hope there. And also the installation of the institutions of military control in the wake of the fall of the Libyan government and Libyan society. So, imperialism driving, even though you had an anti-racist movement partially, certainly claiming to be driving Obama's election and administration, but imperialism winning the day actually helped move white supremacy along just fine.
Oh yeah. And that's why, we might be at a new moment, Don. I mean, and history moves through contradictions, and there are forward advances and sometimes setbacks, but nonetheless, and we are at a moment of very, very sharp contradictions, and the system, probably since the 2007-2009 economic collapse, has entered a new stage of crisis. I call it a systemic crisis and an existential crisis. Some might say, well, you're overstating it. I don't think so.
We'll see.
And some people who comment upon this situation, say that we're looking at or we're in for a prolonged period of decline in the system, where conditions worsen on a global level, including within the most developed capitalist countries, and there will not be a quick and easy resolution to this crisis.
Like sliding into a new dark age or something, you know?
And those in power hunkering down and preparing for a prolonged struggle and prolonged crisis.
Tony, thank you very much. This was a little unusual for us to go through two newscasts with this conversation, but I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much, Don. It was a pleasure.
What happens in the United States does indeed have some real-world effects out in the real world. Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford talks about the role of the U.S. on the world stage.
If the United States were not a superpower, it would be the joke of the planet, a nation whose government tells the most outrageous and ridiculous lies, and may actually believe them, and whose corporate media report those lies as gospel truth. The latest whopper comes from the mouth of James Mad Dog Mattis, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, who claims the Russians are providing weapons to the Taliban in Afghanistan. The charge is insane. If there is one major power in the world that has consistently fought against Islamic jihadists in Afghanistan and everywhere else, it is Russia. And the major power most responsible for the rise of the Taliban and other jihadist outfits is the United States, which teamed with Saudi Arabia and Pakistan to create the International Jihadist Network in order to force the Soviets out of Afghanistan almost 40 years ago. Despite that history, beginning in 2009, the Russians allowed the U.S. to use Russian airspace to supply American troops in Afghanistan. It was a vital lifeline for the U.S. mission in Afghanistan, which could not be adequately supplied through Pakistan. The Russians were hoping that the new American president, Barack Obama, would make an honest effort to improve relations with Moscow, which, of course, never happened. But mainly, Russia was acting in its own interest. Afghan heroin devastated Russian society, and Islamic jihadists have killed thousands of people on Russian soil. Jihadists from Chechnya have done the most damage, but Russia has a vital interest in combating Islamic terror in the Muslim former Soviet republics, especially Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and Kyrgyzstan, which all border on Afghanistan. For Russia, the war in Afghanistan is a domestic issue with a direct impact on the drug trade and terrorist attacks on Russian cities. The suicide bomber that blew up a subway train in St. Petersburg, Russia, killing 14 people earlier this month, was from Kyrgyzstan. Nobody has to tell the Russians about the threat of Islamic terror. While the Americans, the Saudis, and Pakistan remain the bulwarks of Islamic terror, providing billions in arms and training for Islamic fighters all over the region, the United States and its NATO allies provided the air force for jihadists in Libya, and then did the same thing in Syria for al-Qaeda, which became so powerful that it split, with one branch becoming ISIS. ISIS now vies for influence and territory in Afghanistan. The ISIS fighters that the U.S. targeted with the biggest conventional bomb in its inventory, a MOAB in Afghanistan this month, came from Pakistan, Washington's longtime ally, which also continues to be the home base for the Afghan Taliban. So, when the United States makes the outrageous charge that Russia is aiding the Taliban, it's like the mafia complaining about organized crime.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.